Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, we continue exploring Hollywood's influence on the politics in the U.S. with historian Stephen Ross. Then, unscientific America. How does scientific illiteracy affect our nation and world? Finally, when does democracy have a dark side? We'll speak with Professor Michael Mann. Last week, we began a two-part discussion with Stephen Ross, historian at University of Southern California, about his book, Hollywood Left and Right, which is just out in paperback. We talked about the early political efforts of Hollywood movie stars, including those of Charlie Chaplin and Louis Mayer. Their efforts influenced the politics of the United States, but also had an influence on how other performers participated in politics. This is part two of that discussion. Welcome, Stephen Ross. Great to have you.
Thanks for having me.
Here's a quote right out of your book. Movie stars do more than just show us how to dress, look, or love. They teach us how to think and act politically. How so?
Well, I think one of the great things that movie stars do and have done since the 19-teens, is they draw attention to issues. And people who are anti-Hollywood, and it's not even conservatives, because you have a lot of conservative stars who have been political, but people who are anti-Hollywood just simply dismiss it and see it as star worship and what can they tell us, et cetera, et cetera. They miss the big point. The big point is, right from the start, when movie stars started going out on the road, starting in World War I, selling war bonds, or when they started going out on the road with candidates, what would happen, the biggest influence movie stars have had is actually they get us to think. It's not what they have to say, that our lives are busy. We often don't pay attention to things. We think things are, it's the same old, whether it was 1917 or today. But suddenly when somebody you get that you admire gets involved in either a cause or a candidate, it draws your attention. And once it draws your attention, you're the one who decides, am I going to actually read something about this? Am I going to listen to this person? Am I going to find more about this cause? And what has done it is, again, it's the celebrity who has brought you to it. These polls, I get very upset when I read these polls about, well, let's go back to 2008. You know, first time she endorses a candidate. Is Oprah's endorsement more likely to make you vote for Obama? It's the wrong question. The real question should be, would Oprah's endorsement or any star get you to pay more attention to a candidate or an issue?
So it's the agenda setting function.
That's right. Because otherwise, if you say, you know, yes, it's going to get me more likely to vote, you sound like a moron, that you have no real brain. And in fact, what it is it simply gets you to pause for a moment.
We've got Warren Beatty. We've got Charlton Heston. The legacy of Ronald Reagan and Arnold Schwarzenegger. Do you see a development of how their politics have come, or do you see them more individually compartmentalized?
It's interesting. I would say stars on the left have been more individually compartmentalized. And ironically, the stars on the right have followed a trajectory of how to use media. And again, not just followed a trajectory, created a trajectory of how to use media to further their political goals. So I mentioned Louis B. Mayer is the first one who starts with radio and figures out radio. And also Mayer, by 28 and 32, is staging the Republican conventions, and he's turning them into entertainment venues. He says, you know, a convention is no different than a movie opening. So you got to stage it. It has to be a big hullabaloo. It has to be a big gathering. People need to want to see it rather than ought to see it. Murphy pioneers the use of television. I mean, he's talking about camera angles, about makeup. To me, what was interesting, in 1948, he's telling Tom Dewey, audiences don't like you. They may vote for you. They don't like you because you're a smarty pants. You always have a quick answer. And he tells them, next time you go on TV, flub a line. And in fact, go on with a mustard stain on your tie. Look human. And Dewey blows him off and then loses the election. And 2 years later, when he runs again for governor, uses everything.
Did he put a mustard stain?
That I'm not sure, but he changed his appearance. Arnold Schwarzenegger is the next big breakthrough. He's truly the first one not just to understand the nature of 24/7 media, but use it. Schwarzenegger, if you look at people like Murphy, who goes on to become senator. For some of your listeners may not go back that far, remember, but Murphy was senator of California, elected in 1964. Reagan is elected as governor in 1966, and as we know, president in 1980. But what we don't know, when Schwarzenegger ran in the recall, the newspapers got it wrong because they kept talking about how he was similar to Murphy and Reagan, two B-movie stars who simply went into the political arena without knowing much. They just, you know, used their celebrity. They were totally wrong. Murphy and Reagan had worked in the trenches, worked as part of the building the conservative movement, Murphy from the 30s on, and Reagan really gets involved in the 50s with conservative politics. He's shifting from a liberal Democrat to liberal anti-communist Democrat and finally a conservative Republican by the early 50s. But when they enter the political arena, they've had 2 decades of working with Republican groups around the country, but particularly in California. What's interesting about Schwarzenegger is the first Hollywood figure to run for office with no real political ties. The only thing he had done is really campaign for George H.W. Bush.
And he married a political family.
That's right. He married into the Kennedys. And it's something, you know, I found some of his early writings and interviews. And when he was 18, he said, here's what my life is going to be. I'm going to be famous. I'm going to be a celebrity. And then I'm going to be a famous movie star. And then I'm going to be really wealthy. And then I'm going to marry into a famous political family and go for office. And everything he has said as a young man, he did in his life.
He probably didn't predict the latter part, though, with the affairs and the...
Well, he didn't say that, but he that's beyond that trajectory. But he did everything he said. And when he ran, what audiences probably don't realize is he got the recall was the greatest thing that could have happened to him. Because if he had to go through a Republican primary, I don't believe he would have gotten the nomination. Because Arnold is very much like the liberal Republicans of the late 1960s, very conservative on fiscal and defense issues and liberal on personal social issues. But in a contest of 150 some odd people running in the recall, he has the big name and he's able to win. And the other thing he does is he runs on his celebrity and not on the issues. He decides early on that, in fact, he said later on, Ted Kennedy, his uncle, gave him the advice, delay talking about specifics, because once you talk about specifics, they're going to tear you apart. So when it's less than a week to go from the election, and the LA Times runs a full page where they have, I think, roughly about a dozen of the leading candidates, and they've got these little boxes of like 6 major issues, and in a phrase, what the candidate says about the issues, Arnold's columns were completely blank. And it was only a week to go that he started talking about some of the issues. He was running on his celebrity. He was running on his fame. He was running on lines like, I'm going to tell legislators who aren't doing their job that they are going to be hasta la vista, baby, and talking about them as being girly men and really playing and doing a lot of stunts.
He got 45% of the vote, I remember. Would that have worked in a regular election needed more than a majority?
It would have worked in a regular election if he could have gotten through the Republican primaries. But I don't believe he would have beaten Tom McClintock that time in the Republican primaries because the Republican Party was too conservative. They would not have gone for Arnold.
But again, the fact that he got 45% of the vote, or some thereabouts, I may have the number slightly off, suggests that maybe he couldn't have gotten a majority at least the first time out on those particular celebrities.
Well, I think you're wrong. When he's running against somebody as lackluster as Cruz Bustamante or even Tom McClintock, those were his two big opponents. Remember, we had 2 votes. One, are we going to recall Gray Davis? And if Davis is recalled, who do you vote for governor? And you had Cruz Bustamante, Tom McClintock, the outside Arianna Huffington, and Arnold.
Arnold Schwarzenegger, you point out, tended to always have a particular political ideology that was conservative fiscally. His predecessors, like Ronald Reagan, they sort of moved from ideology to ideology, didn't they? Especially Reagan.
Well, they didn't move from ideology to ideology. They moved from left to right. That's the other interesting thing I saw is George Murphy started as a New Deal Democrat and quickly became a Republican. Reagan started as a New Deal Democrat, and in his autobiography writes, even at the end of World War II, he called himself a bleeding heart liberal, and eventually moves to become a conservative Republican. Charlton Heston was the first Hollywood figure to march in a civil rights parade demonstration. He was a liberal Democrat who endorsed the New Deal and was, in fact, a liberal Democrat up until 1972, and then he became a conservative. Arnold never was a liberal. But here you have several figures moving from left to right, but I've never seen anybody move from the right to the left in terms of movie stars. And I'd love to know, if anyone can think of it, you can email me at sjross@usc.edu. Or just go on the history website at US University of Southern California, because I can't think of a prominent star on the right who moved to the left.
As we were talking, we've sort of skimmed over a couple of the famous people that you did chapters on in the book. One was Harry Belafonte.
And of all the people I interviewed, absolutely the most charismatic person I've met. With Harry Belafonte, I discovered a story that was not in the history books, that is really only being known now, both through what I've written on him, but more what he's written in his own autobiography, where he's finally come out and talked about. Harry Belafonte was one of the Martin Luther King's two closest friends. Harry Belafonte was the single biggest donor to the civil rights movement. And Harry Belafonte essentially walked away. He had a career as both a movie star, a TV star, and most successfully as a singer. And again, what audiences may not know, in 1957, at the kind of peak of his career, singing-wise, he was selling more records than either Elvis or Frank Sinatra. And in 1959, disgusted with what he saw as the lack of politics in Hollywood on television and music, he walked away and went to work for King for the civil rights movement for the next 9 years. And when I asked him how, and he, the more and more he told me about this, I said, yeah, I've read this stuff. How come, you know, people mention you were there and you were participating, but we have no idea what a central role you played. And he laughed and he said, well, that's because if you are a radical fighting the forces of capitalism, imperialism, and racism, you need to build as many alliances as you can. And you need to build a genuine big tent, not a rhetorical one, where everyone on the left is brought together. And you can't afford to have these factional fights on the left that has paralyzed the movement forever. And consequently, he became the only person who could move between the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, SNCC, CORE, all the other Urban League, all the other groups, and particularly SNCC and the SCLC began to really fracture as SNCC got more militant in the latter part of the 60s. And Harry Belafonte was the only man they would listen to because they trusted him. And he worked, and he used to say, I didn't want to be in the spotlight. It would have been very easy for a celebrity like me to get a lot of national attention. But the movement would not have been taken seriously to have a singer movie star as its head. It needed to be focused on Dr. King. And that's why I purposefully stayed under the radar. And the only time I came out is when Dr. King, which is what he called him to this day, Dr. King would say, Harry, we need money. And then I would go do a bunch of concerts and take what I needed for my family and give the rest to Dr. King.
Now, wasn't he also affected personally by his commitments?
Yes, it really undermined what people also don't know, unless you've really paid attention, is his mentor was Paul Robeson, the most, as Adolph Monju said, the most dangerous black man in America. And when Monju was testifying, Adolph Monju was probably the most conservative actor in Hollywood during the 30s and 40s. And when he testified before HUAC, the House Un-American Activities Committee, and they asked him, how would you define communism? He said, well, I can define communist. Anybody who goes to a Harry Belafonte concert and applauds is a communist. Or, excuse me, to a Paul Robeson concert and applause is a communist. Well, Robeson became the mentor for what I would call the Harlem Left. Which is in the late 40s, it was Belafonte, it was Ruby Dee, Ozzie Davis, and Sidney Poitier. And when Belafonte got called before, actually he was called before some of the Red Baiters for participating in this. He was supposed to go on the Ed Sullivan show, and they weren't sure they'd let him on. And he went to talk to Robeson and said, what do I do? And Robeson said, Harry, remember, use your art as a weapon. I was making, you know, six figures until I got blacklisted, and now I'm making $2,500 a year. Basically, he told them to tell him what they wanted to hear. And so it wasn't that Belafonte lied, but he sort of feigned ignorance. I didn't know these groups I was singing at were left. You know, gee, I'm not going to do this again. So he got to sing on Ed Sullivan and continue his career. But it affected his marriage when he and his first wife divorced. She claimed it was about politics, that all he could think about and talk about was politics, that he ignored his family, he ignored his wife, he ignored everything on behalf of his politics. And when he got married to Julie, who is a white woman, he also suffered because for Harry Belafonte, he believed racial progress will happen when we don't talk about the color of who we love. And it got him in trouble with whites, it got him in trouble with blacks. And so he suffered a great deal for his politics.
Just a reminder that you are listening to The Scholar Circle. I'm Maria Armudian, and we're speaking with historian Stephen Ross about his book, Hollywood Left and Right, which is just out in paperback. Now, if we fast forward one more time, what would you say Warren Beatty's legacy is?
Well, Beatty is really interesting because Beatty did, most of the stars I wrote about did a particular kind of activism. Beatty was doing everything. He was active in the political trenches working for candidates. In particular, he was the media advisor and part of the inner circle both for George McGovern's campaign, but then became really a key advisor for the Gary Hart campaign, really talking to him about, in a sense, the Democratic equivalent of George Murphy. How do you use the media to present your ideas in the most effective way? And we're no longer in a day and age where you can talk for an hour and people get to listen. You have to talk in sound bites. So he was trying to train both McGovern and Hart. How do you talk in sound bites? How do you get these crisp, to-the-point sentences? And at one point I was interviewing Gary Hart, and he told me, I can still remember being in Warren's kitchen, and, you know, I was going through one of my speeches with him, and he kept interrupting me, you're taking too long, you're taking too long, you're taking too long, get to the point, get to the point, get to the point. So Beatty was really instrumental there, except, you know, as people pointed out to me after reading that chapter, they said, yeah, but these guys all lost.
Both of them, yeah.
Well, it wasn't about necessarily winning, because that gets into a whole nother issue about what I call the 50.1% dilemma that's run through American politics, particularly left politics, which is your goal to get elected, to do what you need to do to get elected, to get that 50.1%, and then when you're in office, in other words, you may have to compromise, but you compromise, you get into office, and then you fight for what you believe in. Or the other side says, but if you compromise so much to get that 50.1, you have nothing left to really bring to the office. And Beatty was a believer that, you know, you have to say what you wanted to say. And ideally, you want to get into office, but you got to raise the consciousness of the people. So I don't think he saw himself as a loser, even though those people lost the elections. The other thing Beatty did is he said, well, and in the end, because he was asked to run for Senate, and if people may remember, people were trying to approach him to run as the Reform Party candidate in 2000 in the presidential election. And the Reform Party was the party that got Jesse Ventura elected governor in Minnesota. And he felt ultimately that, no, I can do more politically in film, because in film, I control everything. And if you look at his films, from Bonnie and Clyde to Shampoo to Reds and to a film that I particularly like, Bullworth.
I loved Bullworth.
These are very political movies, particularly Reds and Bullworth. As a Shampoo, these are very stinging political commentaries, and Beatty gets it because you're trying to merge entertainment with politics. You're not trying to make movies that are on the nose. You're trying to make movies that can entertain audiences, and in the course of entertaining them, you give them a strong political message. And so he's had that career as movie star activist, candidate activist, behind-the-scenes advisor. And, you know, now it's sort of his, you know, he's run his course.
You're a historian, so using the past as a basis to look into the future, Do you see up-and-coming actors who might be taking on the role of the next?
Yes. The only one I can tell you on the left who has a shot at this moment is George Clooney. Because if you look at, you know, who's on the left today that people would know? Sean Penn, George Clooney, and Alec Baldwin. Well, Sean Penn is too far to the left for most people. You know, once he goes and he's a big Hugo Chavez supporter and he's in the front row, along with Harry Belafonte at Chavez's funeral, that's enough. That's it. You know, you have no chance. Alec Baldwin, liberal Democrat, left liberal Democrat, but, all, you know, the minute they play that tape of him leaving the phone message, forget about his wife. People can understand you getting mad at your wife. You can't insult your child in the way he insulted her, calling her a fat pig. And that would, they would just play that he has no chance. But George Clooney has followed what I call the route that in many ways Charlton Heston pioneered, which is image politics, where you have a cinematic image that is so strong and so positive that people begin to believe that the image and the man are one and the same. So if you look across time, one could say on the right, someone like John Wayne had that, Jimmy Stewart had that, on the left, Gregory Peck had that, Charlton Heston had that, Moses. First he used it on the left, because it wasn't just being the first guy to participate in a civil rights demonstration. He led the Hollywood contingent on the March on Washington, and he used the Moses image very much to promote left causes. And then after 1972, when he broke with the Democrats, he used it on behalf of gun control and Republican candidates. And I believe that today George Clooney has the image as a positive straight shooter, somebody people would believe. You know, Eastwood had that as a conservative, but, you know, he harmed himself at the last convention. The talking to the chair just,
yeah.
I think people thought the guy's lost it now. Yeah. He's lost. And that's the problem of an actor who believes he can go off script. He's not as bright as he thinks he is. He's not a dumb guy by any means, but you can't go off script at a national convention like that and suddenly bomb and expect to have the influence anymore. But it would be Clooney on the left. And I don't think there's anybody right now on the right who I would say, it, you know, it has that gravitas that could attract maybe somebody from the, what I would call the independent side or the uncommitted side.
And finally, given the enduring legacy of Ronald Reagan, which really has shaped American politics for decades.
Right.
Do you see a new shape developing as a result of somebody Hollywood, or do you think it's going to be a continuation?
No. First of all, as people who look at this carefully would say, it's no longer Reagan, because Reagan would still be too liberal for many. Certainly for the Tea Party, he would be too liberal. I think we're seeing now a major shift, and I'm not sure which Republican is going to come out of Hollywood. But it's going to have to be somebody who compromises more. All you have to do is look what's going on in the Senate and in the House. And it's Republicans are realizing the demographics of this country have changed. Old conservative white men are no longer to be able to rule in the same blatant way. They will still rule this country, but they can't be as blatant anymore. And right now, the whole idea of immigration reform passing, of trying to create a compromise on gun control, these are all Republicans see that they have to move back towards the middle a little bit. They have to move from the extreme right to the far right. You know, they're not moving into a liberal position. It's not going to be liberal Republicans anymore, but it will be not Tea Party ruling. So if there's going to be a candidate who comes out, it's going to have to be somebody who can play to what became known as the Reagan Democrats, that is blue-collar Democrats who got so fed up with the seeming liberal politics of the party that they sort of moved into the Republican camp or they became independents. And right now, certainly amongst young voters, independents, I believe, are the fastest-growing sector. So you're going to have to get a Republican who can speak to that group, who can be a gentle. It's what Schwarzenegger tried to do. And for a while was actually successful until he couldn't rule. And that's something Warren Beatty pointed out when he was asked and pressured, won't you run against Schwarzenegger in 2000? And what Beatty said is, you know, I know how to run for office. That's not the problem. I don't know how to govern in office. And those are two different things. And Arnold knew how to run for office. He didn't know how to govern in office. You can't insult legislators.
And then work with them.
I mean, it's one thing to do it in a campaign and in general, but when you get kind of calling them girly men and getting to that level and talking about how they're inefficient, how you're going to get rid of all of them, and then they're all there, how do you expect to work with them? And then, again, attacking them in that way, once you're the governor, you can't do it. I mean, and that's what you saw. It is, he kept saying running a campaign is like running a movie opening. And he's right. You want to create a lot of pizzazz. But once the movie opens, the movie has to carry itself. And Schwarzenegger, the governor, the movie, was not strong enough. The previews look good, but the actual movie didn't work at all and fell flat. And he went from being, if we remember, there was time people were saying, let's have a constitutional amendment to allow immigrants to run for presidency. That wouldn't float now.
Well, Stephen J. Ross, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Again, the book is called Hollywood Left and Right. When we come back, Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy is Affecting Our Nation and World. We'll be right back. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. Science is no longer cool, according to our next guest, and this could have huge consequences for our nation and world, which needs science to help resolve many crises facing us today. But Americans are paying less attention and giving less credence to science and scientists, due in part to politics, mainstream media, religion, and the ongoing anti-intellectualism in the U.S. How did we get so far off the scientific track, and what should we do now? That's the subject of a new book co-authored by Chris Mooney and Cheryl Kirschenbaum. It's called Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future. Chris Mooney, welcome to the Insiders.
It's good to be on.
Great to have you. So I guess I want to start with the bad news. How bad is this?
Well, you know, Americans don't know a great deal about science, and so if you ask them questions, you know, how long does it take for the Earth to go around the sun? What's larger, an electron or an atom? You get pretty dismal responses. You get some of the most dismal responses on things related to religion, like, do you believe in evolution? How old do you think the Earth is? Do you think the universe started with a Big Bang? Those kind of things. So we don't know a lot. We're also just not very engaged with what's going on in the world of science.
So would you say that this is largely a failure of the education system? And I ask this, of course, because these are things that you learn in basic science courses.
They are, and science education in the U.S. is pretty dismal overall. There's some great schools, and there's a lot of, you know, not great schools. So some students get incredible educations, but it doesn't spread, it doesn't reach everyone. And that's part of the reason for these data. I don't think that it's solely an educational problem, though. I mean, it's a very complex problem. And so we talk about the role of the media and in informing or misinforming people about science. We talk about the political system and how cynical politicians and political activists are with science. And we look at a lot of other factors as well as just the education system.
Yes, indeed. You've actually cited a few things in your book. For example, John McCain and Sarah Palin ridiculing research on grizzly bears.
Yeah, that was you know, a way of scoring points. I forget what McCain's line was about grizzly bears, but it was a silly comment, and it turned out that the research that he was making fun of was actually very important research.
And then you actually go back to an old political scientist, Richard Hofstadter, who talked about anti-intellectualism in the U.S. and how this kind of really feeds into it and supports it.
Yeah, we don't like the pointy-headed thinkers, you know. We think that
pointy-headed thinkers.
They, you know, they don't do anything. They're just lazy and read books. And, you know, the American spirit is all about, you know, starting a business, making a lot of money, that kind of thing. So there's this whole sort of idea that somehow that's not what Americans do. Hmm. And science can fall into that whole thing. And so nobody wants to be a brainiac. And kids, a lot of kids grow up, unfortunately, in high school. They decide that that's not me. I'm not that kind of person. I don't do science and I don't do math.
Now, this is cultural, a cultural phenomenon that is fairly new. I mean, although we know there's been a long time of anti-intellectualism in parts of the United States, and Hofstadter wrote that book, I think, back in the 60s. But we also know that there had been, historically, a lot of preeminence placed on science.
Right. Well, the founders, some of them, you know, most notably Franklin, especially Franklin and Jefferson, were, you know, scientists of their day, although the word scientist hadn't been invented yet. But if it had been, it would have been used to describe them. They were natural philosophers. And, you know, there have been other periods when science was very preeminent in American life, too. And in the book, we talk about the post-World War II era, because scientific technologies, military technologies, won the war. For, you know, with sometimes somewhat unfortunate consequences in the case of the bomb, but also then especially the post-Sputnik era when we felt that we had to be competitive with the Soviets, and we invested in an unprecedented way in science in America. And for about a decade between the launch of Sputnik and our landing on the moon, science was everything in America. And then things got more complicated again.
One check on the media I thought was quite telling was cable news, which gave 1 minute's coverage of science and technology while they gave 10 minutes of coverage for celebrity and entertainment.
Oh, yeah, and I'm sure that, you know, they're giving a lot, you know, a lot more to crime, a lot more to sport. You know, I mean, the amount of attention devoted to science in much of the media is not only tiny, but it's apparently dwindling. And one of the things that we do in the book, and that I've also been doing in other writings, is sort of telling the stories of all the individual science journalists who had long and distinguished careers, and they're all now losing their jobs at newspapers, as newspapers sort of have to cut back in this economic situation. And the science people are often the first ones to be fired.
Well, there's several aspects of that that I'd like to talk about, and we'll get to them all. One is the internet and its impact, and you talk a bit about that. But also, before we even go there, I wanted to talk a bit about these scientists over, you know, the last 50 years have at one point been really an important fixture in American history. And we had Carl Sagan, for example, and you talk about this. There used to be programs on CBS, on ABC, on PBS that really covered these important breaking technologies and such. And then we had a little bit. You mentioned Stephen Hawking. You mentioned Richard Feynman, Jared Diamond on the bestseller list. But there's other stuff going on. Talk about all this.
Yeah, what we do in the book is we kind of give a brief history of the popularization of science. You know, when was science really prominent, and when were scientists really prominent? So that, you know, so that they were on the point of actually being household names. You know, if you poll people today, most of them can't name a scientific role model, you know, and the names they give are people that are long dead, you know, like Einstein, or they, you know, name non-scientists like Gore or Bill Gates. But Sagan is a person that a lot of people really did know. He really was that visible. You know, not as famous as Einstein, certainly, but, you know, really quite famous. You know, everybody had seen him on television. And so in the figure of Sagan, science was a part of a shared culture that we had. And we don't really have that anymore, I don't think. And I think the polling data bears this out. You ask people to name a scientist, and you don't get living Americans named. You ask people if they know a scientist personally, you know, they don't. It's just not part of mainstream American life, really.
So what is the consequence of this, and what's ultimately at stake?
Right, well, that's why it matters. I mean, you know, if we were just saying people don't have the right facts in their head, I don't think that would be a compelling argument. But we're saying more than that. We're saying that we live in a time when science is more pivotal than ever to the future, to decision making, and that's obvious if you just follow the news. Global warming is one of the top issues on the agenda right now, and most of the public, well, large parts of the public, are in complete disagreement with the scientific community about the whole basis and the fact that there's a problem. So we have this gigantic disconnect there, and global warming is probably the best example of how scientific illiteracy hurts the future, which is that if you got a public that refuses to listen to science on the topic, then you have what we have, which is 20 years of gridlock. inability to deal with the problem. That's just one of many, many, many science-centered issues that are either being currently bungled or will be bungled in the future because the unhealthy way that we deal with science.
You know, one of those practices of the media, which is not necessarily a negative practice, except for that the consequence is negative, and that is that any time they offer up a piece of science about, say, global warming, they always have a naysayer. And so it makes it look like there's a debate.
Yep, and it's so foolish to do this because I don't know, journalists should all be aware, I don't know if they are, that there's a strategic attempt to create these naysayers by special interests and by conservative political interests who want to fight the science of global warming. They basically create, out of nothing, misinformation about science, and then they're just dying to go in the air with it because this is the whole political strategy to create gridlock, and they've done exceedingly well with that strategy, and so no respectable journalist should be a party to it.
We've got, of course, the role of the Internet. One of the concerns with the Internet deals with how newspapers are folding. Most people are getting information from the Internet now, but of course that is not really well vetted. Talk about this.
Right, so this is the whole new problem of science and the Internet. And if you're going to talk about science and culture and science communication, you can't ignore that. And everything is changing, and everybody knows this. I don't think it's a particularly healthy environment for science because what you had with the treatment of science in the old media, in the newspapers, was you had these sort of veterans, people who knew the field and had covered it for a long time, and they knew all the experts, and they had very strong standards for what they would write about and why they would write about it. They were professionals. Their jobs are basically being destroyed by a technological and economic dynamic that's generated by the Internet. And so who's replacing them? Well, it's bloggers, you know, for the most part. And the bloggers are a completely different cast, and they might provide really good information about science, but they might, you know, provide really bad information about science. And in fact, you know, one of the most popular, quote, science sites is an anti-global warming site. And they're very popular anti-vaccine sites. They're very popular anti-evolution sites. So it's a wild west out there. There's no quality control. And then there's a second issue, which is about audience and what people read and what they get. So, you know, again, the newspaper as a form of media was supposed to reach a diverse audience. It wasn't just for the people who read the sports section. It wasn't just for the people who read the horoscope. It was, you know, the newspaper gives you a diet of all the different things, and it's meant for everybody. So that meant that science, when it was in the newspaper, was part of everybody's diet. But now, no longer, you have the Internet where you choose all the content. And in that context, most people aren't choosing the science content at all. Most people aren't even going to be finding it.
And there are also the pseudo-documentary types of things that people are finding in lieu of real science. And, you know, maybe I should bring you in, since you are a science journalist yourself, to talk about the process of peer review and why that's important.
Oh, absolutely. Peer review is a time-honored scientific norm. And what this means is that, you know, a finding in science isn't really treated as something to be taken seriously unless it has been vetted by, usually anonymously, another couple of experts, at least a couple in the field, and then published in a journal that won't publish something unless that's happened. So that's a quality control measure, and it's a way of building confidence. And peer review isn't foolproof, but it's very, very important. And there are various kinds of peer review, and once things have been peer reviewed lots and lots of times, you have high confidence in them. And a journalist worth their salt, you know, writing about science, would be very concerned about the standing of the information. And they would look for peer review. They would look for various different kinds of peer review. That's the problem with all the misinformation out there on things like global warming, is that it hasn't passed the test. But nobody knows that except for the scientists.
And instead, people are getting their information from whether it's a science blog that really is a business, mm-hmm. and not really operated with any kind of integrity, or from their neighbors?
Yeah, they could be getting, I mean, you know, let's switch to evolution because we've been beating global warming a lot, you know. I mean, you live in a religious community and everybody around you is anti-evolution and you all go to church together. What do you hear about evolution? You hear, oh, you know, there are these things in the cell that cannot be explained by evolution, therefore Darwin must be false. You hear this again, it's the same kind of misinformation that gets spread all around, and it's not peer-reviewed, and it's not quality science. It hasn't been published, but, you know, it's got a huge following out there.
So there should be some kind of fact-check for science. If anybody could create that, it would be quite something, kind of like the fact-check we have for politics.
Yeah, well, You know, no, it's extremely hard with science, too. Science is some of the hardest stuff to fact-check. And again, I'll speak as a science journalist. I mean, you really, really, you learn early on just how easy it is to fool somebody with scientific-sounding stuff and just how hard it is yourself to get it right. So the people who want to misinform, they have all the advantages because they don't have to work as hard. They don't have to check things as carefully. And they are more able to make things up than we are.
So, Chris Mooney, what do you think has to happen now to go back to a place where science is better understood, the wool can't be pulled over the eyes of people quite so much, and when policy and science are actually working together again?
Well, fortunately, the good news is we've got an administration that does get this, and that helps a lot. The hardest area to fix is the media, so let's just table that for a second because that's a real big economic problem. But, you know, we really got to wake up about the U.S. educational system. There's so many problems with it, and the people teaching science often don't really even know much about science, and you could hardly get somebody better when the salaries are so low. So, you know, that's a fundamental problem that really speaks poorly, I think, to our values. But there's much, much more that can be done. And what we talk about in the book is not just educational reform. We talk about the people who care, because there's really a large constituency for science in America. We created a movement during the 2008 election to try to get the candidates to talk about science, and we had some success. You know, when we had 38,000 people out there calling for this. So to get the people who care, the scientists and the science supporters, to rally around a cause of improving our communication of science to the public. And that involves doing a better job of getting science in the media, doing a better job of getting science into the political system, doing a better job of getting it into the entertainment media in a non-completely garbled form, which is another topic, doing a better job of getting it into churches, which is super hard for some churches. So a grand campaign to sort of reacquaint America. Science world.
Well, Chris Mooney, I want to say thank you for joining us. Let me tell our listeners one more time that they are listening to one of the co-authors of Unscientific America, How Scientific Illiteracy Threatens Our Future. The book is out now, and thank you so much for being with us.
It's been fun. Thanks.
When we come back, is there a dark side to democracy? Stay tuned.
Some man, where you gonna run to? Down, press a man, where you gonna run to? Down, press a man, where you gonna run to? All on that day, you gonna run to the sea.
This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org, and I'm Maria Armudian. Democracy, the idea of governing of, for, and by the people, is a long exalted principle, particularly here in the U.S. But our next guest suggests that democracy may also have a dark side. He suggests that majorities can and do oppress minorities, often in the name of majoritarian democracy. In the worst case scenarios, this has led to murderous ethnic cleansing and ultimately genocide. We're joined now by Professor Michael Mann. Michael Mann teaches sociology at UCLA and has authored several books, including Sources of Social Power, Fascists, and the subject for today, The Dark Side of Democracy. Welcome, Michael Mann.
Thank you for having me, Maria.
Great to have you. So you open your book with historical figures who had allegedly embodied enlightened reason along the line of Thomas Jefferson, for example. And yet Thomas Jefferson and others justified exterminating entire peoples.
Yes, that's right. In fact, we find that with the settler colonies, we find the most direct relationship between democracy and ethnic cleansing, because the greater the level of democracy among the settlers, the more murderous they were towards the native populations. So North America and Australia are really the most exterminatory regimes as far as Native peoples are concerned, wiping out about 97% of the Native Americans of this landmass, and slightly less, 95% in Australia. And where imperial governments were stronger and more authoritarian, as in the Spanish Empire, for example, the death rate was less. So we do find people like Thomas Jefferson, the first governors of California, all urging people to get rid of the Indians. And even with almost all of the Native Americans gone, President Theodore Roosevelt declared that extermination was as ultimately beneficial as it was inevitable. So there is quite a history of this. Settlers who have pretty well-functioning forms of democracy for themselves being more murderous towards people that they define as aliens.
And the other thing I found quite interesting is that you say this phenomenon of ethnic cleansing and genocide, it's not really primitive or alien, it's a modern problem.
I think that the desire to get rid of a whole people is modern. Certainly we find many atrocities throughout history, but when we look at things like the atrocities committed by the Babylonians against the Jews, documented in the Old Testament, we see something else. We see them marching in, coming across the first Jewish city, demanding surrender, and if they don't surrender, they will all be killed, so say the Babylonians. They don't surrender, the Babylonians storm the city, they kill all the inhabitants. But that's a military tactic. That's supposed to get them, the other cities, to surrender. And, of course, the other cities do. And this kind of practice was normal in earlier history. But the notion of wiping out a whole people is, I think, modern. And the basic reason for that is in previous periods, class distinctions were so great that rulers very rarely considered themselves to be part of the same people as the ordinary peasant. And so they didn't have a very ethnic conception of themselves. Elites in different societies thought of themselves as being closer to each other than they thought of being closer to the masses.
I would think that another reason for this would have to do with something else that you wrote about, which is oftentimes these ethnic cleansings occur when the minority, which may be oppressed, does not submit to the majority. But in the past, it seemed like there were more submissive, when it was more class-based, people submitted a little bit more.
Yes, it didn't matter very much to them whether they were being oppressed by the Jewish upper classes or the Babylonians. Today, there is far more of a common identity between the people and the leaders, and so you have ethnic bonding occurring across class. So, in a way, class conflict, class divisions are a protection against ethnic cleansing.
And which one is worse? Interesting.
Well, in terms of mass murder, I think there's no question that ethnic cleansing is generally the worst, though, of course, you do have these very particular things going on in Soviet Russia and in China, where landlords, kulaks, are slaughtered in very large numbers as enemy classes. But that's very rare.
And in Cambodia?
And in Cambodia, too, you're quite right.
Yeah. Right. One other statistic I thought was striking, and I don't know exactly how this really fits in with your whole thesis, is the civilian deaths in wars and conflicts that, say, in World War I, less than 10% of the deaths were civilian. World War II comes around, it was about half. And now the wars in the 90s, it's like 80% civilian deaths.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Now, how does this relate to the whole democratic argument?
Well, I think that part of it relates, obviously, to new weapons of war, and especially to aerial bombing. But it's certainly the case that we, the democracies, in winning World War II, for example, did engage in indiscriminate bombing. And I'm not thinking primarily of Hiroshima, which you can debate about that. It was supposed to end the war earlier, and it probably did. But I'm thinking more of the firebombing of Tokyo or Dresden, in which the American and British Air Force as well was deliberately targeting civilians in order to destroy the will of the Japanese and German people. Of course, it didn't really work. But there's no question, as far as the British were concerned, there was a strong element of revenge for German bombing of British cities. So democracies, it depends what you count as atrocities. Democracies, if you bring in wars, have been just as atrocious as anyone else.
Now, if we go into your theoretical arguments here, one of the things you distinguished, which I thought was quite interesting, are these two versions of we the people.
Yes.
You have this liberal version that honors the individual and one that you call organic or whole people that seems to be more about the entire community. Why don't you describe these concepts and give us some examples?
Yes. Well, there are two concepts of the people. There's two Greek origins, demos, from which we get the democracy words, and ethnos, from which we get ethnicity and ethnic cleansing. And now these are both words for the people, ruled by the people. And the problem comes when the two get confused. If you think of we the people in the United States, we the people actually meant white males. It was also something, also a political regime dominated by property owners. And so it didn't actually mean everybody. Whereas in the 19th and 20th century, it became much more likely that people, when talking about we the people, would mean absolutely everybody. And this became bound up with a form of nationalism, whereby everyone who was part of the same ethnic group was considered to have the same culture, the same soul. And that since there was a unitary group, a single ethnic group, the state had to represent that, and minorities could not be full members of this state, and so were discriminated against. As you said earlier, it's when the minorities resist that you get real trouble. The normal lot of minorities is to accept discrimination. Maybe they should if it leads to ethnic civil wars and ethnic cleansing.
You know, it's interesting. I was looking through your examples that you argued were evidence of this. And Rwanda, I would like to focus on Rwanda because I was thinking about the ethnic minority, which was the Tutsi people that were essentially annihilated in the genocide, were not really resisting the Hutu power that took the government after the president was assassinated. So can you explain that particular genocide in terms of resistance and laying claims to the same land? Obviously, the Hutu power wanted the land.
Yes.
But it seemed like there was something else to it. And the other thing I want you to address, you talk about how sometimes these genocides and ethnic cleansings are really a plan C, that they don't intend to be genocidal. And I was looking for evidence of this in Rwanda and couldn't quite find it. Can you explain?
Yes, that's two questions, yes. The Tutsis were only 15% of the population, but they were considered by the Belgians, Rwanda was part of their empire, were considered by the Belgians as the natural ruling group, the people with more power, with more abilities, and so they ruled through the Tutsis. And this strengthened the senses of ethnic identity. But in the last years of Belgian rule, there were pressures from Belgium and also from within Rwanda to do more for the Hutus. And after independence, the Hutus came to power. And Tutsis then felt disgruntled. Many of them left the country. Now, it isn't actually true, what you said, that there was no resistance, because there were two things that sparked off the genocide. One was the shooting down of the plane of the president, the Hutu president, presumably by Tutsis.
Yeah, I think that's presumably, though. There's some question about that.
We'll never know for sure, but the balance of probability is that it was indeed Tutsis. The second thing that was going on is there was a Tutsi invasion by the people who'd fled, the Tutsis who'd fled into neighboring Uganda, and they'd been helped by the Ugandan government.
Right, the Rwandan Patriotic Front.
That's right.
But these were not the residents of Rwanda. These were people who had been displaced before, who had come back.
That's right.
Wanted their land back.
Yes, they wanted to win a war and become the new government, and indeed they did. But it's true that the majority of the Tutsis in Rwanda were not resisting. But the Hutus came to believe that these Tutsis were helping the Tutsi invaders. There was a fierce battle going on within the Hutu community, and as a result of the invasion and then the shooting down of the president's plane, the Hutu extremists managed to come to seize power, and as soon as they seized power, they launched the genocide. Let me say that in these 20th century cases, like Rwanda, Yugoslavia, Armenia, these are not democracies doing it, but it is the problem of the democratization process. All of these groups who eventually perpetrated the genocide or ethnic cleansing in these cases were originally seeking a more democratic form of government. And it was when they began to confuse those two senses of democracy, of rule by the people, with a particular ethnic group, that it led towards these terrible atrocities. So I'm not saying in those cases that they were democracies. They obviously weren't, but that it was the democratizing process that led towards.
Is there something in the U.S. that kind of shows an oppressive quality of democracy, of majorities oppressing a minority? But it's not ethnic cleansing. It's just a violation of rights. Prop 8 is the example that I frequently look to, this or maybe in Prop 187 or some of these other propositions. And it really seems to be direct democracy that often is the violating of the minorities.
Yes, well, of course, what direct democracy, what referenda can do is whip up scares and against minorities who seem deviant, and you do get that in the propositions. But I think that, the kinds of terrible atrocities that I'm talking about are in a different league.
They're definitely in a different league.
And I think there is a bright side to what's going on. There is a steady progress of rights in this. Well, not completely steady, but the backlash is unlikely to prevail in the medium term, I would think, because it's clear that society is going in a more human rights direction.
Now, is that because of the kind of democracy that is established here in the United States?
Well, I think it's more general than that. I think that there are social processes going on across the Western world as a whole, and so you have the same kind of thing happening in Europe too now. It's not because there are not referenda in that way. It doesn't have the same drama involved as is the case in California, but there is an advance of these kinds of rights. And I'm not a specialist in this area, but it's obvious that there is a kind of sexual revolution going on and has been going on for some time, and that it partly came out of other human rights, civil rights movements, and that'll probably continue.
Michael Mann, I want to thank you so much for being with us. The book is called The Dark Side of Democracy, Explaining Ethnic Cleansing, and I know I took you a little off track there, and I apologize, but it is something that I've thought about in terms of the dangers of democracy at times whenever the general public decides to violate rights of another, and of course you're talking about the extreme version. But I would like to say thank you so much for being with us.
Okay, thank you very much, Maria.
Michael Mann is a professor at UCLA and the author of The Dark Side of Democracy. That's it for today's Scholar Circle. Thank you to our guests and to our producers, Melissa Chipper and Ankine Agassian, for making this show possible. Also to Sud Dongre, our webmaster, and most of all to you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can go back to kpfk.org and click on the archives, or to our own archives at armudian.com and scholarcircle.org. You can also subscribe to our podcast through Stitcher or iTunes, and follow us on Twitter at armudian.